Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Healthcare's Growing Need for Enriched Diagnostic Services, How Demand for Data, Increased Use of AI, and Genome Sequencing Advances Create Opportunities for Labs. The presenter is William Morris, MD, PhD, President and CEO, Mayo Clinic Laboratories, Rochester, Minnesota.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'll try and keep people engaged as we're in a windowless room and in beautiful New Orleans. So Robert asked me to talk a little bit about healthcare's growing need for enriched diagnostic services, how demand for data, use of AI, and genome sequencing advances create opportunities for labs. So clearly I did not come up with that title myself because I had a hard time articulating it. So just by way of background for me, I am been at Mayo for my whole career. I am currently the president and CEO of Mayo Collaborative Services, which is the parent company of Mayo Clinic Laboratories, our for-profit reference laboratory operating out of Rochester, Minnesota primarily. I'm a hematopathologist by training. I've actually been at Mayo for my whole career since 1987. I tell people I'm homeogenized and I'm a hematopathologist. That was my first iteration of my career at Mayo. So, and you know, one of the things that's interesting about working at Mayo from a lab perspective is, you know, of course, we were the first integrated medical practice probably in the world, if not just the United States. And also, from a laboratory perspective, you know, we're part of the care team. So I would work side by side with the hematologist that was really spurring a lot of our test development and other activities as well. And so you start to get this a view of what the ideal state is for labs and how they support the delivery of healthcare. Then in Mayo Clinic Laboratories, you know, we start serving hospitals on the outside, and you start to see how things are different on the outside. And, of course, this really came to a zenith for me personally with COVID, where you had, you know, testing, which was so needed pervasively by society and yet was so difficult to get out there and understand. And I think, and coming all, if you look at all the struggles in healthcare, I'm not talking just labs, it's just in healthcare post-COVID, between difficulties with access, difficulties with burnout of staff, these things, it's really a reflection of the fragmentation of our healthcare system, right? And so that's one of the things when we pivot and say, well, how can that title kind of, what is the context that we should be aspiring to address this? Is probably one way that we're going to start to flatten it, then lower those barriers that are really an obstacle to the best delivery of healthcare is by thinking about data, right? With evolving tools and technologies, there's certainly an increasing demand for data, right? Just think about the panel I had the privilege of hosting today. I mean, it came up multiple times, the need for data. The need for data harmonization, how data and having access to data is going to be key, particularly around, like when we talked about value-based reimbursement for labs, the response was that, yes, but we need the data. It needs to be consistently demonstrated through the data, right? For us in the laboratories, we are really struggling with, in some respects, or blessed by, it's a little bit of a blessing and a curse, the fact that the platforms that we use are generating increasingly intensive amounts of data. So my background was in flow cytometry. When I started, most of the flow cytometry instruments were two or four color. Going to four color was a big deal, which means each cell had four specific analytes that you were examining. Now we routinely use 10 to 12 color in a clinical flow assay, which means that for each individual cell, you can evaluate many different combinations, right? That's one example. There's genomic data. Next-generation sequencing is an obvious example. Again, when I started, PCR was just coming into its kind of strength, its forte, and now NGS sequencing has completely changed the game, where rather than looking at a target, let's just sequence everything and use a bioinformatic pipeline to make sense of it. And we'll continually see this evolving. Genomics was a start. Some of us that are more protein chemists would say that was the easiest place to start. But proteomics, metabolomics, and then last but not least, you know, I'm a pathologist by training. I think about how many pieces of information am I analyzing when I look at a slide? You know, and so you think of all the image data that we're generating. As I was thinking about this talk, it's really, you know, and again, this is not specific to labs. It's actually, I think, even more kind of broader than that. we've seen this kind of coincident evolution of the amount, ability to generate these massive amounts of data and things that now have ultimately led to large language models and ChatGPT. So we have this parallel track. We're increasing the amount of data that we're creating, and now we're creating all these tools to really interrogate that data and try and make sense of it and draw conclusions. And in some cases, some would argue even replicate human thought as it does those things. And that's so these are all massive trends that have really hit the laboratory. Why? Because the laboratory, as I mentioned today, is generating 70% or more of the quantitative data in the health record. So we're going to be an obvious place for that intersection to happen, so we need to understand them. Ideally, we need to understand how to harness them and use them to make changes in laboratory medicine and in healthcare that are real opportunities for us to make a difference. So stepping back again to the – just taking a look at the U.S. lab market, because I know we have – You have some non-U.S. people here as well, which is great. This is a situation in lab today, in lab industry today. So it's a $100 billion market in the U.S. If you look at the two biggest pieces of a pie, there was not surprisingly Quest and LabCorp, right? And they would argue that they, you know, each have about 50, you know, close to 50% of the outpatient of the lab market. But really, I mean, that's the outpatient lab market. The majority of testing is still performed within hospital laboratories. And in addition, there's a lot of other private labs out there, some of them, many of them, most of them, high quality, many of them very specific use cases, you know, a company like Exact Sciences, right? So we have tests and testing being performed in a panoply, I would say, of different environments. But the challenge is that those environments don't really talk to each other. They're not designed to be interoperable, right? So ultimately what happens is that in some ways this undermines the overall value of lab medicine because it's all approached in such a fragmented way, right? And so you look at that and you say, well, how, you know, the economic factors that drive this are not going to be easily overcome, so if at all. So then you have to say, well, what are some other solutions that might be out there? Well, first you have to look at, I think, as a, putting doctor hat on, you know, what are the symptoms of the problem that needs to, that there's really something that needs to be solved? And I think it really is about the patient experience, right? And how patients experience healthcare. So, you know, if you think of most patients, that they, if they get access, again, let's just use COVID. It's such a, I know we all want to forget about it, but it's still very much a mind, in our mind example, right? A lot of people, and I was on the radio and other venues trying to explain this to people, because what happened is that, okay, you needed a COVID test to do anything, right? You needed a COVID test. People were using the test to understand, should they have a family gathering? Is it safe for me to go? I got a positive test. What does it mean? When you create a piece of information for that has a significant impact on a person's life, and you just give that piece of information in a box, it doesn't really help with a lot. It creates a lot of dissatisfaction, right? And that's not unique to COVID. Patients get this a lot where they get diagnostic information back at them, but it's not presented to them in a way that's cohesive. And even if it is, if they take that and they want to go to another care system because people need to move between care delivery, and that's even within our own health system at Mayo sometimes, that information doesn't flow with them, right? So what they experience then is a long, either a lot of fear and angst about what does something mean, or just challenges around getting, you know, out of pocket, or all of these things. And so what we have to, if diagnostics are really driving the healthcare journey, then it's incumbent on us to try and create a more seamless experience for our patient, right? And so I think that that's, from my mind, although as I said this morning for any of that were there, I'm not a math guy at all, so it's pretty ironic that I'm talking about data. But to me, if we create a new universe, it's going to have to be really driven by the fabric of that universe is going to be the data itself, right? So we have to think about, first and foremost, the needs of the patient, and the needs of the patient coming first. Whatever we design has to be that someone on an operating table can get an answer much more quickly about whether or not they need a full resection with margins, right? If you have cancer, are you a candidate for one of the newer immune therapies, as a for instance? We have to think about the results and how they're delivered back to the patient and the provider and the environment that it is, and how much information do they need and how they need it delivered and when, so that they can get to the right therapies, right? And then to me, the beauty of it, and this is, again, working in a place like Mayo where we do a lot of consultative work. Of course, the pathologist, some people call the doctor's doctor because we have a consultative profession. The beauty of if we do, there's so much data. it's overwhelmed us in our ability to kind of get it the right data to the right expertise. And if you look, a lot of medical errors and errors in interpretation, it's not even about the quality of the data, it's just the data didn't make it to the right person to notice the right thing to make take the right next step. So you have to say to yourself, okay, if that's the case, and we're now creating more information, and it's from more complex platforms that are more difficult for people to understand, what's the answer? How do we go forward? Well, I think the answer really is in how we think about the data more holistically, right? And so we have to think about all the information that's being created, and then how should it be interconnected? How would you use those different pieces of information to answer a question? Or how would you use that, you know, again, how would I use that information coming from the lab to even understand or identify when someone's on a complex care journey, right? Because I take a very personal example. I have a sister, went in for a relatively minor corrective procedure following her birth of her child, went home, went to a really nice hospital, went home, called and said, I'm feeling sick, and the doctors that did the procedure said, well, you probably have the flu. It sounds like you have the flu, but maybe you should come in tomorrow. And so she came in the next day. She wasn't particularly febrile. Luckily, she was feeling poorly enough that my mom went with her. And they said, yeah, you certainly got the flu. Just go home and take some fluids. By the time she got to the parking lot, she collapsed. And why? Because she had unidentified sepsis, right? Which means that we didn't have the right – that was a complex situation that the physician, who's a good physician, didn't have the right information to clarify. No, this is – yes, 90 people coming in, 99 people coming in probably have norovirus. One person has sepsis, right? And so how we start to think about that to get to the right answer – right, is we start to think about how can we, if we have the data and we have the data available to us and we have these tools now that can interrogate that data for us, how do we start to structure our healthcare and diagnostics delivery system that we can put in a layer of machine learning or artificial intelligence that starts to filter out and starts to help us and understand and recognize complexity where there's complexity or get to answers more quickly. This is really the promise of thinking about creating this holistic approach. And I think genomics is probably the first area where we've really had been forced to think about this. Because, you know, even when we were moving to more high-color flow, at first I felt like it was multi-parameter flow, I guess I should say it, is we're kind of using an elephant gun to try and swat flies, right? Because most of those tools were developed to do immune interrogation of complex immune subsets, which typically may someday be clinically relevant, but more researchy. But to me, the real watershed moment was next-generation sequencing. Because next-generation sequencing was a technology that was designed for someone trying to solve the problem of how do I sequence a human genome, right? It wasn't designed about how am I going to do a great clinical test, right? And so now you had this platform that could generate much more information than we could comprehend. And so the only answer was to start to create these tools. Well, that's continued to accelerate. I mean, there's now what Ultragenomics has like a $10 whole genome. I mean, sooner or later, it's going to be so inexpensive to generate this data. The challenge would be, what the heck do you do to it? A, and B, from a payer perspective, when do you even generate it, right? And again, that's why I was really glad to see that on the panel today. Because on the one side, someone that's thinking about how to make sense of it also has to think about how is it going to make sense to a payer. Because I think what you heard today from both the Palmetto folks as well as Zyphen is that they don't see the logic. You know, they can't go end-to-end to say I should be reimbursing for this, right? So if there's a lot of promise here. I think we'll continue to see advances in data acquisition that will force us in this direction. So what, I guess, the transition, and then what do we need to be thinking about, right, in the lab perspective to make sense of this? Well, it first really starts with, if the data is coming out of our shop, it's really getting engaged in another area which I never saw myself being highly engaged in, and that's our IT systems, right? We have to think about the IT systems. Most of our IT systems are not designed to deliver on this kind of operating model. So if you start to think, the power of envisioning the future state is then you can compare your current state capabilities to what the future state requirements will be and then start to move in that direction or find partners that want to move in that direction as well, right? So and we need IT systems. They're still going to need the stability. They're still going to need the reproducibility that and the compliance that we need out of our LISs and healthcare IT systems. But networking and somehow ability to put other API and other functionality on top of it is going to become more of the paramount feature as we go forward. So thinking about the IT system, because IT systems are expensive. So, you know, you should be thinking about and understanding what are the capabilities of your current system. If you're looking to replace it, what are the capabilities of the replacement system as well? Data architecture, another critical thing. I mean, we don't put data into, even at Mayo, the vision of Dr. Farrugia is to move towards platform, a Mayo Clinic platform, and that means kind of putting the Mayo Clinic data, as we say it, from our 100-year integrated, 150-year integrated practice, what we call behind glass, so that we can, you know, people can do inquiries and run tools, and we're building federated data networks with other academic medical institutions domestically and abroad. But the reality, even within our own shop, it's been a lot of work to get the data harmonization because there's bits and pieces that are just locked up. We'd like to get them, but they're just not structured in a way that we can cross over and get it unless you put a person in there that has to start kind of, I start needing basically data Sherpas, right, that can say, no, this is where the machine needs to go. So you have to be thinking about that now. The other big one for us in the laboratory, and I mentioned it today, is data governance, right? Because once the data is in the EHR, the flip side is anyone can start running tools against it or going to access it, and they might not even have the same insights or they need the Sherpa, and they won't have the Sherpa, right? So knowing, and we worry a lot about this in digital pathology again, where we spend a lot of time putting slides in. At Mayo, we're on a journey to digitize our whole archive. Well, who's going to annotate that, and who's going to be able to understand, you know, if it's worthwhile and the data is actually ready, if like a nephrologist wants to go look at our renal biopsies, you know, who's going to help that individual? Would they just have unfettered access, and what would that result in? Regulatory requirements. I mentioned this today, and you could put reimbursement in there as well. You know, if these tools, I thought it was Lila just said it so well. I mean, all labs are operating on a thin margin business, which is a whole other issue around supply chain and other things, right? But who is going to, you know, these are not free. You need to hire people. So who's going to kind of, what's the financial incentive for the lab to do these things if they're going to improve care, which they will? Also, what are the regulatory requirements? Who's going to regulate these? I mean, that was bought up quite clearly. I don't know that we just heard today about, or yesterday, about the regulation of LDTs, and then there's a whole other layer on top of that really is very murky for us. And then last but not least it gets back to patient. If we're keeping the needs of the patient at the center, what about people that feel differently about having someone access their data, right? How do we make sure we abide by their concerns and their desires? So I thought I'd pivot here a little bit then, because that's all very high level, and talk to you about kind of how we're using this data, what's one approach where we're doing this today at Mayo Collaborative Services. And it's actually not in Mayo Clinic Labs. We have some things that are running more in the labs, so we are now separate. The academic department is still, we're still the primary conduit back and forth, but the academic department's working on a lot of cool stuff about AI and flow interpretation and other things. For us, we have another business within Mayo Collaborative Services, which is our biopharma services. And so biopharma, why biopharma? Led by Dr. Jason Hipp. Because if you look, I mean, one of the things about Mayo Clinic, as I mentioned, we're the first integrated medical practice. We've been keeping the real genius of Mayo, the Mayo brothers, of course, but actually it was a guy named Henry Plummer, if you ever visit. There's now the original Mayo building is now the Plummer building. So Henry Plummer was a surgeon, a colleague of Will Mayo's, I think, at Northwestern. They convinced him to come to Minnesota, and he was sort of the genius savant because he developed our charting system, and so we had an integrated medical record paper going all the way back to the early 1920s. And we keep everything. We keep all of our blocks and slides and our records, and so we have this treasure trove of data, and it goes way back, and it's longitudinal. And again, because we're Mayo in the Midwest, most patients stayed with us for the entirety of their care journey. So we have this great amount of data. We have a partner Inference that allows us they have really advanced NLP, the most advanced NLP problem, natural language processing in the world, so we get access to that data. And then we can look and say, that means we can look back at our oncology patient data for at least 50 years and find all these different, and again, Mayo's kind of the answer shop, right? So it's a lot of routine stuff, but it's also a lot of highly complex stuff that people couldn't figure out. We have their slides. We have their blocks. We have their medical records. We have their treatment records. We have all of this information, and we have it for a lot of different cancers, as you can see here, right? So the question was, right now, how can you unlock unique insights out of that data that might make a difference for someone? A patient, yes. In this case, not a patient being treated, but rather a patient that a pharmaceutical company looking for an effective therapy for a patient, right? So the question then becomes how to unlock it. So, and how do we augment it? So we've created this Mayo Clinic Biopharma Diagnostics, and we've been working with biopharma partners, but we've been with them and saying, what are the sorts of platforms that you're interested in when you're looking at patients with cancer to identify responders versus non-responders and candidates for therapy? Because as it turns out, a lot of the innovation in diagnostics is now coming out of the pharma space as they have these more and more expensive drugs like immune response modulators, right? And it becomes much more challenging to find out, you know, identify what is the key feature here. Now, these things, part of my interest is because I had to grow the business as part of my job, or Dr. Frugia, you'll have someone new here next year, or perhaps I'll be in a different role here next year if I'm not successful. But as importantly, this is an area, again, where there's a lot of desire to bring new technology into the diagnostic atmosphere, right? So this is an area where we're looking at multiplex immunohistochemistry with platforms like Akoya, where you can now look at many different markers on a slide. You don't have to put something into a flow cytometer. There's a lot around 3D pathology. There's a company, AlpenGlobe, but there's others, because as it turns out, you know, the next layer of pathology information, for me, it was a lot about identify the cancer type, is it invasive, you know, what's its grade, which again was another Mayo innovation by Dr. Broders in the 1920s, not to get too home teamy. Now it's a lot about, well, what's the architecture? What's the stromal response? What's the microenvironment? You know, these are things that we don't really have the tools in routine histology to do. And so we need to create these in an environment for us economically, honestly, where we're going to get paid for it. Because this is, you know, the options right now are to do it in a research lab, which means it's not really going to filter to clinical practice soon, or to find a partner like a pharma partner that wants to create this. But these are expensive, right? And so the most important thing then, if we're going to do all these things, how do we identify the right group of patients to actually understand where this depth of information and interrogation will be important? And then, and this I think is really tells a very nice data story, right? So if you start at the top, we can use tools now to go into our records and identify the right patient populations. Example, a patient that was, you know, low HER2, didn't respond to Herceptin, but had these specific attributes, colon cancer with a lot of microsatellite instability, had these specific things. We can now go and we would have had to hire extractors and multiple people to go extract from the record. We can now use the data tools that we have to actually develop in silico cohorts and find and confirm that these are the unique patients that are of interest in understanding further, right? We then can work with a partner to say, okay, what's the right information? We've digitized our archive. It might just be off of the H&E, but do we need to do more? Do we need to go back to the block and do multiplexed immunohistochemistry? Do we need to do a proteomic assay by mass spec? Do we need to do something else to understand and generate data about this patient and their disease? And then, again, without the tools of large language models and machine learning, we have no ways to really analyze that data. So you put on there and you start to say, okay, let's analyze the data, put it in an environment where we can analyze it, and then develop algorithms. Because the whole point is, and this is the other thing for me personally, so I was the fourth or fifth hematopathologist hired at Mayo. I think there's like 30 now. Why? Because our only way to scale our knowledge is to hire more people and try and train them to do what Bill did, but just do it better, right? So you don't have to move them over to administration. So, but reality is it's just not scalable, right? So then you start to say, okay, if these are the observations we need to make, how can we develop an algorithm that actually helps us to scale that knowledge? And then how do you verify it? And then how do you deploy it? And the beauty of this is that if you do this correctly, number one, you can execute the trial. But number two, it's going to actually identify the beauty of, like, when I was getting my PhD, I never forget, my thesis mentor said, the beauty of a good experiment is that it generates 10 more experiments, right? So as you start to create the system to work, you'll find more and more opportunities where you need to deploy the system. And you find new biomarkers that you can move more quickly into the clinical realm. And if you also do it right, you start to think about, hey, I can start generating the data today, because that's the most biggest problem with innovation. I went to J.P. Morgan, which is the big biotech conference, and it just was fascinating. And maybe it might be my Midwest sensibilities versus the Bay Area of the United States. But there are a lot of people there like, you're going to innovate in healthcare because it's cool, you know, but why does anyone want to pay for it? I'm like, well, because you haven't done all the other things that make someone want to actually pay for innovation beyond its coolness, because we're not at the Apple store and buying a very expensive mug because it looks like my iPhone, as a for instance. So, and keep my coffee warm. If you have to think, and that's the other thing about innovation, is you have to think about all the stakeholders and what's going to motivate them once you show your innovation works to actually want to adopt it and employ it and help you scale it, right? So we can start to collect these things now, and then really thinking about how do we start to grow this pie so we can really achieve this vision, which is from Dr. Faruja, and that is to really get to this whole, and I showed this slide last year too, so... You know, for those of you that want to, I know it, in case he's lazy, he just shows the same slides. I just think it's a good slide. It's a cool slide. And it's a great quote. And it's that if we really want to influence healthcare, we have to really think about clinical diagnostics from the spectrum of the in-lab delivery to the innovation as an array of not getting away from Bill has a cool biopharma project, I have a cool test, to independent, we have this array, interconnected platform ecosystem, right? That we get a more seamless cohesion because, you know, again, nothing more frustrating to a patient. I'll use it as a kind of closing example here, the companion diagnostics that was discussed today by Dr. Stenzel. And I remember speaking with Dr. Pazdur, the head of Center of Excellence for Oncology at FDA. And, you know, of course, one of the challenges with a companion diagnostic is that it can be very frustrating for a patient because now you can only get access to the drug if you can get access to the test. Right? So how do you start to think about, if this test really works and this drug really works when we know we do this test, how do we make that as scalable and accessible to patients as possible? Because the thing that I was very much struck with during COVID was how much disparities in access to diagnostics drive disparities in access to care. And again, going back to the simple example of COVID, you could do a study by zip code and looking at availability of testing by zip code, and it was directly correlated with worsening out, lower availability directly correlated with worsening outcomes. So if we're not thinking about this, we're really not thinking about it. Of course, the cost is one thing, but then just thinking the availability is the other. So with that, and then this is one of my favorite quotes ever from Peter Drucker, the kind of godfather of modern business thinking. The best way to predict the future is to create it, and I think it's incumbent on us in the labs to do so. And I will stop there and thank Jane again for rescuing me from a crashed computer and take any questions that you guys might have. Thank you very much.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.